Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about a Van Eck ETF later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. I am so happy to welcome to Forward Guidance for the first time, Peter Buchvar of the Bleakley Advisory Group and author of The Book Report. Peter, it is great to have you on Forward Guidance. I can't believe this is the first time we're doing this because at my first job at Real Vision, I think on my first or second day, I met you there. You were being interviewed. From the start of my financial journalism career, I've known you. So it's really glad to have you on Forward Guidance at last.
Thanks, Jack. I'm happy to be here and congrats on all your success so far.
Thank you. Peter, what are you thinking about in markets? What is keeping you up at night?
I've been worried about over the last couple of years with the sharp rise in interest rates and the economy's adjustment to that, of more of a death by a thousand cuts. Because when interest rates jumped at the fastest pace in 40 years, not everyone is impacted by that all at once. It all depends on when your loan was coming due. And that on top of the cumulative rise in inflation, I do think that we're beginning to really see the economy rolling over to growth rate at best 1.5% type activity with threats that it's even weaker than that. I mean, the debate of recession, no recession, it's actually, somewhat nuanced because if you look at the behavior of lower to middle income consumers, they're essentially in their own recession. If you look at manufacturing, it's in a recession. If you look at the pace of existing home sales, it's in a recession. On the other hand, the higher income consumer is doing just fine. Travel, leisure, hospitality, doing just fine. Anybody who's the beneficiary of all this government spending, doing just fine. So it's a highly mixed economy, but I think in the aggregate, there's real growing threats here. And then we throw on top of that the labor market, which to me is really cooling off. So I think the Fed is going to be cutting interest rates in September. They'll probably follow that up in December. But I think one distinguishing factor this time around compared to the last few decades is that any rate cutting cycle is going to be much more methodical, and the Fed's just not going to have the same license to respond to an economic downturn like they have in the past. Because I believe that inflation is not just coming down to 2% and magically staying there. I think inflation volatility is here to stay. Let's enjoy the deceleration we're seeing right now. But the war on inflation is not won unless inflation stays down, and that remains to be seen.
And do you think that a potential slowdown or the series of mini recessions that you're talking about, the lower end consumer, that the housing market, that will be a stopper or bring inflation down? Because recessions are bad, inflation is bad, but often a recession causes inflation to go down and sometimes causes deflation, which in itself is, can be bad. Are you worried about both recession and inflation? Or, if there is a broader slowdown, do you think that will break inflation down?
It's a tricky question to answer because we could see similar, dynamics that reflect a bunch of those factors. I mean, look, we've had a 30-year low in the pace of existing home sales, but home prices that are at record highs and up almost 50% since 2021. That's the epitome of stagflation. Home prices that are up and no activity. So you could see, and I'm not worried about high inflation again like we had in 2022. I'm more worried about after this deceleration of inflation, which will continue, we'll see two handles in CPI in the back half. PCE, which I don't really like as a metric because of its heavy weight towards healthcare that the government pays and through Medicare and Medicaid. I prefer CPI. So that'll dip to 2-ish as rents decelerate. But I still think that that there is an inflation mentality out there that is not going to be easy to fight. And where's most of the deflation that has taken place or disinflation? It's on the good side. Well, all of a sudden, you have shipping costs that are going through the roof. We entered the year. Well, let's back up. February 2020, the average price of a 40-foot container shipping from Shanghai to Rotterdam was about $2,000. It went to about $15,000 in the panic in late 21, early 22. And then we entered 2024 at just under $1,700. Well, it's now 8,000. Reasons we all know with all the Red Sea diversions and Houthi attacks and so on. But that should be a reminder that that's someone's going to have to eat that. Someone's going to have to eat a 4x increase in shipping costs, since most everything that is produced in the world starts out on a ship before it gets to its end destination. So I think that's just a reminder that the inflation fight is not just easily won. We're getting certain deceleration in rents that will continue to show up. But after the flood and record amount of supply coming on stream this year and into next year, there is now almost no multifamily projects getting greenlit. So the back half of 26, or maybe even early part, assuming the absorption rate of the current supply, you're going to see rents inflect right back up again. So I think this is going to be a multi-year drawn out process where I think sustainably looking out over the next 3 to 5 years, inflation is going to be 3 to 4, not 1 to 2. And that means that interest rates are going to stay more elevated. The Fed's not going to have the same license and sort of hall pass to just do whatever they want with interest rates in response to an economic downturn. And I don't even think Jay Powell is also afraid, I think, of getting too aggressive, because he doesn't want to end his career, where his term ends in February 26, with a reacceleration of inflation. That would be his worst nightmare.
It would. Peter, I know you listen to a lot of earnings calls. What is the tone? We're just starting earnings seasons now. What is the tone on those earnings calls? Is business up or is it not doing great?
So what we've heard over the past week has been mostly things touching the consumer. The biggest disaster this week was Helen of Troy, whose stock fell about 28% after they reported earnings. This is a company that makes everything from, you know, water bottles to hair dryers to curlers to mirrors to brushes under brand names that we've all heard of. And they really got smacked by a more discerning consumer. Pepsi talked about a more discerning consumer. We also heard from a company called Kura Sushi. They own 64 restaurants in 17 states, including DC. They talked about a macro-driven slowdown in their consumer. Conagra, owner of Slim Jim and making popcorn and frozen foods, talking about also that more discerning consumer. And that follows a few months of other consumer touching, whether it's a retail or restaurants, all talking about specifically the lower to middle income consumer that is really pulling back from the amount of money they spend. I mean, one of the glaring examples that really stuck out to me was a company called Casey's General Store, which owns convenience stores in the Midwest. And they said their customer is being so careful that when they go into the store and they specify the lower to middle income, they're getting, maybe they're getting some sort of food, but they're getting fountain soda instead of getting a can or bottle out of the fridge. That tells you that even to try to save 50 cents or whatever the difference is, tells me, wow, this is a consumer that is really careful. We've had multiple quarters in a row of the CFO of Walmart referring to the U.S. consumer as being choiceful. And this is a big chunk of the U.S. economy, as we know. And you have to wonder, and let's extrapolate that to what's working in the market. And those are, of course, the big cap names. If I'm a lower income consumer and I'm buying fountain soda, am I going to upgrade to the new iPhone because Siri is a little more enhanced? I mean, there's no connecting the dots here that the business of a lot of these big tech stocks are dependent on the health of the consumer and the health of small, medium-sized businesses. I mean, up until the huge Russell 2000 rally, which I'm glad happened because we're long a few of those stocks, the index was down on the year. Well, if small, medium-sized businesses are challenged, you know, how much software and services are they buying from Microsoft and how much advertising needs are they going to buy from, you know, Meta and Google? Now, we'll see, of course, with earnings. But it's a really interesting mix of things going on here. And, you know, the divergences between big stocks and small stocks is not just a technician's discussion about where the market goes from here. There's a fundamental reconciliation that needs to take place too.
And Peter, how do you wait? How do you interpret these earnings calls? Because as you know, for at least 2 years, the CEOs, the CFOs on the earnings call, they've used this phrase, challenging macro environment, which I think just means anything that bad happened this quarter, it wasn't because of us, it was because of the challenging macro environment, whether it's inflation is too high, consumers are choosing down, interest rates are going up. The reality of running a business, as you know, there's always something going bad. How do you interpret, you know, just because people address a challenging macro environment from an actually challenging macro environment, if that makes sense?
It does. It's, you know, we know it's like a retailer blaming the weather for soft business. So you're right. I if I had a dollar for every time I heard challenging macro environment in a conference call, but you know, some of it is true. I mean, if you look, if you're in the business and manufacturing or the industrial space, yeah, it's been a real challenging environment for almost 2 years now because of not only the shift away from spending on goods to services, but also inventories that have been very lean that everyone in the supply chain wants to keep them lean. So you're not getting that inventory restock that you would ordinarily, and there's just a very limited visibility. You know, speaking of earnings calls, you know, the day we're taping this, Fastenal stock is up, but they talked about no green shoots that they're seeing. MSC Industrial, which is a major distributor too, and that competes with Fastenal, they lowered guidance about 3 weeks ago, followed up with actual earnings, and their business is soft too. So there's no real lift there. So I do see legitimate reason to blame the macro if you are in retail, not catering to a higher income consumer. If you're in manufacturing, broadly speaking, because the recession in manufacturing is a global thing. It's not just in the US. So I think it's a legit excuse. And just because, and I say that because I'm hearing it everywhere. It's not just a couple of one-off businesses that are blaming it. I'm hearing it everywhere.
Forward Guidance is brought to you by VanEck. The VanEck Morningstar Wide Moat ETF, ticker MOAT, has outperformed the S&P 500 for over a decade. How? Moat strives to achieve a simple but challenging task. Buy quality stocks when they're undervalued and sell them when they're overvalued. Visit VanEck.com/MOATFG to learn more. That's VanEck.com/MOATFG. Now the disclosures. All investing is subject to risk, including the possible loss of money you invest. Visit VanEck.com to carefully read a prospectus before investing. The VanEck Morningstar Wide Moat ETF is distributed by VanEck Securities Corporation, a wholly owned subsidiary of VanEck Associates Corporation. Thanks. Let's get back to the interview. Are you hearing that on the consumer discretionary side? And if so, how do you square the general pessimism on consumer very discretionary companies' earnings calls with the fact that retail spending continues to be gangbusters?
Well, retail spending is really just gangbusters in certain areas. It's gangbusters if you're in the cruise line business. It's gangbusters if you're in the concert business, or if you're in the sporting event business. I mean, I went to the Las Vegas Sphere a couple of weeks ago, and face value, if you include all the fees, you're talking $350 to $400, and it was packed, and you wouldn't know that there was any consumer sensitivity to things. But if you are going into a Starbucks or a McDonald's, you know, they're cutting prices, meal plans to $5 because they're trying to drive traffic. It's a very sort of bizarre dynamic here in how the consumer is behaving here. But look at the consumer confidence number that we just got from University of Michigan. Came in, I think it's 66 was the read. It was 101 in February 2020. And University of Michigan talked specifically about that lower to middle income consumer that's just a lot more stressed. And it's not just stress because you're dealing with the high cost of living in terms of your daily essentials, but it's literally the high cost of living in terms of shelter. Because now if you're in a home, you're fine with a low mortgage rate, whatever. But if you're a young person that's having to rent, even though rental prices have slowed, they're still up a lot the last couple of years. If you're a first-time home buyer, Well, you're dealing with a doubling in mortgage rates and a 48% rise in the price of a home. You know, you're stressed out. And these just happen to be some of your largest consumer purchases. And, you know, you mentioned consumer discretionary spending. It's clear that consumers are mostly spending on what they need and less so on what they want. But on the and I'll confuse this even more. We also heard from Delta, speaking of earnings calls. Delta stock fell because there's too much capacity out there and prices are falling. But Delta talked about still strong travel demand. I mean, they said the Sunday of July 4th weekend was the best travel day they've had in any summer ever. So it's a very strange macro environment. But I think overall, as I said earlier, it just feels like a 1-ish tight percent economy, not necessarily recession yet in the aggregate, even though, as I said, there are parts of the economy that's in a recession, but just overall sluggish growth, I see.
And do you have a view on if it's going to get worse? Because sluggish growth is not a recession. You said 1% growth. I assume you meant real growth, so inflation-adjusted growth, which is not great, but it's definitely not a recession. What would it take, do you think, to tip this economy into recession? And I should say, you know, some very well-respected people who we both know think that the U.S. economy is already in a recession.
If the labor market continues to weaken, which it has been weakening, we can look at the upward trajectory in the unemployment rate, the reduction in job openings. Outside of the July 4th holiday, we've seen an uptick in the pace of firings as measured by initial claims. Continuing claims is at the highest level since late 2021. If the labor market continues to weaken, that will be enough to tip you into recession. Now, the question I always get when I make that argument is, okay, what type of recession are we going to get? And the reason why it's uncertain is because the higher income consumer we know is the strongest part of the economy. Literally, that and government spending is holding the economy on their shoulders. So what would negatively impact that higher income consumer? Ironically, it could be aggressive rate cuts, because that higher income consumer is benefiting from a 5% interest income or interest rate on their savings. Also, a key determinant on where the economy will go in this more stressed environment that the Fed's trying to address is, where does the stock market go? You know, if the stock market craps out at some point because of recession worries and what that means for corporate earnings, that wealth effect impact can have a notable impact on that higher end, and then further any economic downturn. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's something that is a key part of this discussion about going into recession and what type of recession we may have in terms of its severity or not.
And what are your views on the stock market, Peter?
Well, just as we've had sort of this two-lane economic highway, the same has been said with the stock market. We have two different stock markets. You can't just say, what's the stock market doing? Because you have what the S&P 500 and NASDAQ is doing. Meanwhile, the top 10 stocks in the S&P make up 37% of the index versus 27% at the peak in March 2000. So that's one stock market. And then we know there's everything else. Whereas just, you know, 2 days before the taping of this, the Russell 2000 was down on the year. The mid-cap 400 index was flattish on the year. The equal weight S&P was up 4% on the year. Now, I'm hopeful that we get some broadening and the small cap, mid caps catch up. But a lot of this has to do with this reconciliation that I'm still searching for. And how can these big tech stocks that everyone's piling into continue to do so well? Now, I understand NVIDIA and Dell and Supermicro and AMD and Broadcom, where your customers are those big names. And I think 40% of NVIDIA's revenues come from the four biggest companies: Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google. Meanwhile, all four are trying to create and design chips to compete with NVIDIA. That's a different conversation. So that is its own ecosystem that can exist and prosper irrespective of everybody else, but for NVIDIA and the infrastructure providers. The other companies, all this spend is an expense. So if their top line responds to the weakness in the other parts of the market that we're seeing, you know, if the stock market's right in the Russell 2000 and that business is tough because you have legacy inflation, you have 9-10% funding costs and the consumer's crapping out, well, we're going to get, you know, instead of a broadening out of the bigger to small, I'm sorry, the small and mid caps, we're going to get a drawdown and the large caps are going to catch up to the downside to the small and mid. That is certainly a possibility here as well. And I think this is, now we can always say this is one of the more important earnings season, but considering the market cap additions to those big names, this earnings season is going to be really put up or shut up.
Just for the audience, so breadth is an important concept. If it's only one stock in the S&P 500 that's going up, that's an extremely narrow rally. If 500 of the stocks are going up, it's a very broad rally. How broad is this rally, let's say, within the S&P 500? Because it's not just NVIDIA, right? There are very large rallies in a series of names in the S&P 500.
Yeah, well, like I said, if we equal weight the S&P, it's up about 4% this year. So I guess looking at half the year at 4, it's not bad. If you repeat that in the second half, you know, you got a decent year. But you can drive a truck through the difference between that index and the big one. Now, that can, of course, stay the same. I just think that fundamentally, there has to be, you know, Apple is selling phones. Or is that lower income consumer going to upgrade their phone? They may not. They may just hold on for a bit. And I think that it's going to be really interesting to hear. And I don't want to pick on Apple, mm-hmm. of course. I mean, we're long for clients. I'm just trying to use this as an example of this bifurcated economy in addition to a bifurcated stock market. And, you know, I don't see how the stock market can continue. Well, one side of the stock market, the successful part of the stock market right now, can continue to separate itself from the underlying fundamentals of everybody else.
The underlying fundamentals of everybody else. In other words, if Microsoft is doing so well and the stock is up a lot, that should be reflected in other companies having the money to pay for their services.
Exactly. Their customers. You know, I hear the bull case for those names. Oh, well, they don't care about higher interest rates. Their balance sheets are great. Well, yeah, I agree. But they're dependent on their customers. Their customers need to prosper in order for them to buy products. So let's just get back to the labor market. You know, Microsoft sells software and services. Their growth rate is dependent on how many seats they add, how many subscriptions they add. Well, their growth rate goes up when job hiring is robust, but that growth rate shrinks when hiring slows because there are less seats being added. So it'll be really interesting to hear what these companies like Microsoft and other software names have to say. Since they're in the subscription business, they need more people to subscribe and what the slowdown in the labor market means for them. Let's get back to retail. Let's talk about Amazon now. Amazon's in the retail business. We'll have to see how their business does with this stretched consumer. So it's like I said, it's going to be real interesting earnings season, and I think a real tell for how the back half of 2024 will be for the stock market.
And how are you positioning right now? Like, what are you roughly overweight and what are you underweight for clients?
So just because of having to participate in what these big names are doing, clients are long them. But to me, the greater opportunity in the portfolio that I manage, I am focused on other things being commodities, for example. And being long precious metals, energy stocks, very bullish on oil and natural gas prices, uranium, copper. A recent position of ours is in agriculture with a sharp decline in corn and soybean prices, and conjunction with that, a drop in fertilizer prices that I find very attractive now. The Russell 2000 rally of 3.5% on that day, well, I was happy about that because we're long a bunch of small mid-cap stocks that have gotten beaten up and are cheap. And like a few secular growers of companies in very fragmented industries like Mr. Car Wash, where they have 500 car washes in an industry with 10,000. So they have a tiny piece of the market with a lot of growth potential ahead. Monroe, which is suffering from that trade down consumer. They are an auto repair shop, and half their business is changing tires. So you have that lower income consumer that instead of buying a tier one tire, which is a Michelin or a Firestone or a Bridgestone or a Goodyear, they're trading down to a private label and spending, you know, $150 for a tire instead of $250. But they have 1,300 stores and there are 100,000 in the industry. So a fragmented situation that I know that there's long runway. Brightview Holdings, which is the largest commercial landscaping company in the U.S. with north of $2 billion of revenue. So whether it's a hospital, a university, an office park, a casino, a sporting facility, as long as the grass grows, as long as trees need to be pruned, there's an enormous consolidation story in a very fragmented industry. And then also stepping back geographically, to me, the most exciting growth story in the world, looking out over the next 10 years, is the rising middle class in Asia. I don't see much growth in the US. I don't see much growth in Europe. But I do see that this rising middle class in Asia is a very exciting story. And even China is a part of that, because China's middle class is going to double in the next 5 to 10 years. And you have the growing middle class in India, in Indonesia, in Vietnam, in Thailand. And so we want to be long companies that are going to cater to that, like Trip.com, the largest online travel agency in Asia. It hasn't worked out so far, but we're long some of the Macau casino stocks because the Chinese consumer is still under stress, but the gaming numbers are still pretty good. And Macau is making a big push to be the Las Vegas of all of Asia, not just for China. And we're also long some other names in like Singapore and Vietnam. So to me, that's a very exciting story. But you know, the market just generally makes me nervous when I see the multiples that we're trading at in terms of the S&P. I see just this everyone piling into these select few stocks, interest rates that are still rather high, an economy that I see rolling over. You know, I've been doing this long enough to know that it's a moment in time where you really have to watch your back.
And do you think there's been an aspect of a lot of the companies that have gone up a ton, NVIDIA, Microsoft, I mean, especially in the case of NVIDIA, is for fundamental reasons, like the earnings quadrupled. What do you think the stock should do? But do you think there's an aspect, and I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to, you know, the hypothetical person I'm having an argument with, but do you think there's an aspect of people piling in late because they missed the party, either, you know, retail investors, do-it-yourself investors, like myself, or professional investors who were underweight these names, but just had to get in. So they showed their client, hey, we're not underweight. Don't worry, we're up. Because, you know, if you don't own these big names, it's almost impossible to beat the market, you know, this year, if you don't own NVIDIA or Microsoft or Broadcom or any of the stocks that, you know, the AI people like Citrini talk about, you can't miss out on the party, right?
Absolutely. And when you get into that situation, investors become valuation agnostic. It doesn't matter. Don't tell me what the P ratio is. I don't care if it's 20, 30, or 40, or a similar price to sales ratio. This is where I see solid economic fundamentals or earnings fundamentals, I should say. And I want to own it. And it's going up and everyone else is long it. And it's a big chunk of the S&P. And I just have to own it. And to me, you have NVIDIA, which you can somewhat rationalize the move because how fast their earnings have grown. But on the other hand, the only way to sustain that is if you think that a 76% gross profit margin is sustainable, which it is not, just mathematically and competitively. And then on the other side, you have Apple, where the stock price increase has been all multiple expansion. There's been no earnings growth, but you know, it's everyone knows it's become a cult stock, and now you throw in this AI excitement, and then you get a move like this. But when you have stocks that can single-handedly move this index, yes, everyone is pressured to own them, and that's what we've seen. Everyone's piled in, and the market cap moves on a daily basis and on an absolute basis is just truly astonishing. Well, I remember looking back, I remember being there, living it in the year 2000, when you saw Cisco and Intel and even GE get to $500 billion market caps. And that was just, wow, $500 billion. And now it's 25 years later almost, and it's $3 trillion. And it is unbelievable. But we're in that moment where investors are just valuation agnostic, and just tell me a sexy story and I'll pay whatever price it is. Now, we've seen this in the past. We've seen it with the Nifty 50 for sure. And it goes on until it doesn't. And not to disrespect any of these companies, they've done so well, but at some point valuations matter, but they don't matter until they do.
Hello, everyone. Permissionless 3 is coming to Salt Lake City on October 9th. The event for crypto natives is heading west, and we are bringing the biggest names in crypto together for an insane, can't-miss event. Hear from more than 200 industry titans, including Balaji, Mike Novogratz, and Dan Tapiero. The Conversations at Permissionless will be covering the hottest themes in crypto, including modularity, restaking, the Bitcoin and Solana ecosystems, AI and crypto, rollups and L2s, institutional adoption, and of course, the November election that will be right around the corner. We couldn't be more excited about this event. Get your ticket today, and make sure I get some bragging rights by using my code FG10 to get 10% off. That's FG10, stands for Forward Guidance. I want to see you there. Do it. It's going to be at one of the most beautiful places in the United States, and everyone's going to be there. Van Spencer's going to be there. Jim Bianco's going to be there. Jan Van Eck's going to be there. So what are you waiting for? Get your tickets now by clicking the link in the description and use code FG10. Back to the episode.
Right. And I think when earnings grow so much, paying a very expensive multiple for a stock can make sense. For example, I'd say, you know, all the people who were making fun of, you know, talking about how NVIDIA has a price to earnings ratio of 60 in, let's say, March of 2023. Well, if you actually take what they've earned over the 12 months subsequent to then, it had a PE of 12. And so the trailing PE of 50 now, I don't think NVIDIA will grow its earnings what it has over, you know, it can't maintain these growth rates. But
with NVIDIA, yeah. I prefer to value NVIDIA on a price to sales ratio because that gross profit margin is not sustainable. It's just not. And a lot of that has to do with their customers that want to compete with them and the Broadcoms and the AMDs that are going to compete with them. It's just going to get competed lower. That's just economic math. So right now, NVIDIA, or this year, NVIDIA's revenue growth is going to double again. It's going to go from 60 billion to about 100 and 20 billion. But then it slows down. The revenue estimates for next year and the year after, it slows down to about 33%. And then even if you said NVIDIA's revenues are going to grow 20% for the next 10 years, you know, you're still talking about, on at least on a price to sales ratio, something around 10. Historically, price to sales ratio of 10 was a lot.
Yes.
You know, back in 2000 with Scott McNeely, Sun Micro, as everyone watching this probably knows, that he was laughing at people that paid 10 times revenue for his stock. So what we're seeing in these names is just a massive amount of pull forward in terms of stock market performance. And we're going to have to deal with years of growing into that. Now, like, we're long NVIDIA for clients, but it's a valuation agnostic part of their portfolio, where at some point, you know, it'll matter to the downside. I mean, we're going to wake up one day and Facebook or Meta and Google are going to say, you know what, on our current allocation of your chips, we're good. We're all set. We got the allocation that we need. What do you think's going to happen to NVIDIA on that day? So that day is out there. I just don't know when, but for now, it doesn't matter.
Are you a fundamental believer in the AI narrative that it will transform society and in the stock market have a material impact on profits and profit margins? Are you on the spectrum of total believer to I don't buy this one bit? Where are you?
So AI has been around for now 75 years. The first papers were written in early 1950s. You know, technology has been a driving force for society forever. And to me, this new form of AI is really cool. But to me, it's just a tool. It is not the internet. As I heard people say, oh, this is the greatest thing since the internet. It's actually greater than the internet. I'm no expert on technology like some others, but I think it's really cool. But it's just another sort of iteration and advancement in AI that we already had. So I question the revenue use cases. I think that, yes, from a productivity standpoint, it'll save people in certain job functions a lot of time. There's no doubt about it. There's going to be a huge amount of benefit. But in terms of really generating top line revenue relative to the hundreds of billions of dollars of investment that's going into building these models. I mean, these models too, it could be a commodity. I mean, Meta's model is open source. They're saying, here is it for free. Mm-hmm. I question big time the return on all this investment spend.
But it is a huge CapEx spend, which for the time being is good for the producers. Like NVIDIA.
Well, the beneficiaries of that spend.
Yeah.
Which quarter are we going to have to manage where Meta and Google and Microsoft says, you know what, we're still spending all this money, and that all of a sudden then chips into their earnings growth. Now, a lot of this money being spent is being capitalized, which means that depreciation expense is going to be very high for a long time to come. So it's amazing that those companies are getting rewarded for no revenue growth, or maybe a little bit if you have your co-pilot with Microsoft, but their expense structure is going up by leaps and bounds.
And explain when you say it's capitalizing that expense. Explain for the audience what that means.
So you can flow the money you spend through the income statement in a particular quarter, or you don't have to. You consider it that would be an operating expense, mm-hmm. or you can call it a capitalized expense where the depreciation of that spend will be the flow through rather than all that money spent. So it's not necessarily showing up all at once, the money they're spending. They're going to actually spread it out over time. But the money's still being spent. If they're not going to get a revenue offset and a net income offset to all that spend, you know, these companies are locking themselves into a higher cost structure for many years to come. So this AI build out, I would much rather be owning NVIDIA and AMD, the beneficiaries of all that spend, rather than the spenders of that spend on hopes that AI is just going to be this very profitable product. I don't see that being the case. I see it being a tool that consumers and businesses will use, but I don't know if it's a product.
Yes. What if you're right about that? Don't you think there would be a pretty severe correction on the horizon because all of these multiples and, you know, increase in market caps for stocks have been based on, you know, what you're saying is somewhat of a hope and dream that will not occur. And when reality strikes, that could be pretty bad.
I think that test awaits us in those names. And I don't know what quarter it's going to be, but at some point now, but you can even read whether it was a Goldman Sachs report just recently questioning the value of all this AI spend. Roger McNamee, the famed tech investor, was on CNBC. I think it was either this week or the week before, questioning the return on all this investment and the use case of AI. Like, questions are beginning to be asked, which I think is healthy to do. It's an important discussion to be had considering the amount of money that's going into this. And so I do think we're getting closer to a point where investors start to say, show me the money. NVIDIA has shown the money, no doubt. The picks and shovels providers are showing the money.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But even that, you look at Dell. When Dell last reported earnings, their top line growth in AI-related servers went up a lot, but they're not making any money on them. So I do think show me the money questions are going to start to be asked, and whether it's this quarter or the next couple of quarters, I think we're getting closer to that time frame. So yeah, like I said, we're long some of these, but it's a very nervous long.
It's a nervous long. Peter, one word I noticed you haven't used is the word bubble. And I'd love to ask you, why haven't you used that word? Is it perhaps because the companies that are experiencing this remarkable bull market are, whether the AI thing is as big as promised or not, they are very high quality companies. You're not seeing the frenetic bull market of 2021, where a company that no one's ever heard of is going public at a 30 billion valuation, and then 2 years later, it's at trading at less than a billion. Narrowness maybe could be a good thing if only the good quality companies are rallying, and you're not getting the frauds and the low quality companies that may inhabit the Russell 3000. Not that you would ever own any of them, but they definitely are in there. Is it a sign of strength that it's largely the high quality companies that are rallying? And you may challenge that it's only the high quality companies. Maybe you disagree.
Yeah, no, they are. But I don't think we should sort of fool ourselves that doesn't mean that it doesn't work out for them. When you look back at 2000, Microsoft, there was no more dominant company than Microsoft in terms of its market share in the computer software business. They had like 85% of all computers used Microsoft. Apple had a very tiny piece, and maybe there were some others. That didn't stop Microsoft stock from falling 50% and not getting back to that 2000 peak until 2013. Intel Inside was there a more dominant semiconductor company than Intel in 2000. Cisco was the backbone of the internet. And in fact, I went back and looked at Cisco's peak price to sales ratio in 2000 was 24 times. NVIDIA's price to sales ratio today on fiscal year 25, but call it mostly 24, is 26 times. So you can still have great companies, but a stock that so much disconnects from what earnings are going to deliver that you've just stolen many, many years of future earnings in current stock prices. And I know there's a lot of people in the investment business today that weren't around in the late 90s and 2000, but there were real companies back then, and the ones that I just mentioned. GE was a real company. GE had $500 billion market cap, and Jack Welch was the greatest CEO of all time. And we know what happened to that story. So now I understand with this backdrop, markets are just excited that the Fed is going to cut interest rates. And it doesn't matter what economic downturn we may have. Who cares about the lowering income consumer? The Fed's going to cut rates and everything is going to be fine. And I think that's just a dangerous crutch to lean on. And you mentioned not using the bubble word. I've reserved the B word for the sovereign bond market. To me, the greatest financial bubble in the history of financial bubbles was when we had $18 trillion of negative yielding sovereign bonds a couple of years ago. That has now fully unwound, where we have no negative yielding bonds. But this bond bear market the last couple of years has been pretty vicious. And if you look at the historic track record of bond bull markets, bond bear markets, they last 20, 30, and we just got off a 40-year bull market. This bond bear market is not just going to end in a couple of years. So I think that is one of the other things that when you ask what keeps me up at night is that this bond bear market is not over. And let's just say the Fed starts to cut rates, but long-term interest rates actually go up. What happens if inflation accelerates because the dollar weakens and oil goes to $100? This bond bear market is not over. How's the BOJ going to manage further increase in interest rates and trimming QE? What impact is that going to have on JGB yields that can then spill over to European bond yields and French oats and U.S. treasuries? There's this belief that we've gotten over this inflation hump. Rates are going to fall across the board. and everything is going to be fine. And I'm just not as confident that we're just going to have this smooth landing.
And what do you think is a fair value for the 10-year treasury yield, which now is at, 4.2%.
Right. So historically, before central banks experimented with zero rates, negative rates, and QE, it was around nominal GDP. Yeah, I can argue that nominal GDP, if I'm right, that GDP growth is on a real basis, call it 1.5%, and inflation's slowing to 3%. Yeah, you can say 4.5%, we're right around that. That would be normal. So I don't think we're that far off. However, we can't discount the possibility of the market waking up one day to all this treasury supply worries. And the BOJ loses control of the JGB market because they backed off from QE, or inflation picks up again. And so I think that there are a lot of potential dynamics here that is going to not just keep longer term interest rates, because we know short term interest rates will be driven by what central banks do, but long term interest rate, in other words, a bear steepener is upon us. And I think that continues. And I we're somewhat positioned for in a sleeve of my portfolio of some bear steepening. And can we wake up like the Brits did when this liability driven investment unwind created a spike in 10-year gilt yields? Yeah, I think there's more hissy fits to come in long term rates in Europe, in Japan, and the U.S. And that's what I think is a possibility, even though, getting back to your question, maybe the 10-year yield is around fair value, but we know we go over fair value, we go under fair value when markets move. My point is that long rates are not going to fall. So in that short rates are going to fall, long rates are actually going to stay the same or go up. That's where I get the bear steepener, rather than long rates falling too, but not as much as short rates, which would then qualify it as a bull steepener.
Got it. And also, we could call it short rates as the 2-year. Just because the Federal Reserve is cutting doesn't mean the 2-year has to go down. It actually could go up if the Fed doesn't cut by as much as the market currently anticipates, which is now, you know, pricing in a few cuts.
Right. As we saw at the end of 2023, when the short end priced in 6 cuts, that didn't end up happening. The Fed did no cuts, and the markets obviously adjusted to that.
And so you said that you've got on a few trades to benefit from a steepening of the yield curve. Would those be direct, you know, fixed income trades, or proxies such as like being long banks or and the like?
No, it's actually a particular ETF that we like that benefits from more volatility in the bond market and a steeper yield curve and potentially higher inflation.
What do you think about Japan? Before you tell us what you think, catch us up. I'm behind. Perhaps my audience is a bit behind on what's been going on in Japan, but I know you follow it quite closely.
Yeah, so we've been long Japan. Luckily, we're long one Japanese ETF from WisdomTree that hedges out the yen, so we've benefited fully from the rise in the Nikkei.
So that has been really good, right? Because it's been, you've benefited from stocks going up, and you've benefited from shorting the yen.
Yes.
Yeah, that's been.
We've also been long Japanese bank Sumitomo Mitsui Financial. That bet was on the BOJ finally getting out of negative interest rates and widening yield curve control. And my most recent purchase, which hasn't worked out as of yet, is 7&I Holdings, which owns the 7-Eleven brand. That
in Japan or?
So it's a Japanese company that owns 7-Eleven.
Got it. Okay.
About 75% of their stores happen to be in North America. 25% are in Japan. Now, the ratio is not exact. There's a little less than that on either side because they have locations elsewhere, but they plan on adding 50,000 7-Elevens over the coming years in other parts of Asia and into Europe. So there's a growth story there. They just miss numbers because they're still highly sensitive to the U.S. consumer. We talked about the consumer early on. 7-Eleven's business has been negatively impacted by the U.S. consumer. But it was a way for me to also get long the yen because it was a US ADR. Mm. So the yen is trading at around the lowest level versus the US dollar since 1986. It is by far the cheapest major currency relative to the dollar. It got a huge lift the day that the U.S. reported CPI, because we basically locked in a September Fed rate cut. At the same time, we're a few weeks away from the BOJ raising interest rates and widening yield curve control. So I think this yen rally has more legs to it. So we're still bullish on the yen. Now, what that will mean for Japanese stocks, well, you could maybe get a hit to some of their exporters. But I think a lot of their major exporters, like Toyota, is less sensitive to changes in the yen because they've moved so much production outside of Japan. So I still find the Japanese stock market attractive on a valuation basis, a growing return on equity story, a greater governance story, greater shareholder reward story. So I find it very interesting. And getting to my thesis earlier about this growing middle class in Asia, Japanese corporate Japan has got a big customer base that they're going to be able to sell into on that growing middle class. So Japan, while its economy itself has its own challenges demographically, half the world's population is in Asia. And I think corporate Japan is going to benefit from that in terms of trade.
And then how are you thinking about Japanese inflation, which for 20 years, Japan had the problem of deflation or too low inflation, not stimulative. No one's pricing in any growth. Now, Japanese inflation is kicking up to 3%, 2.8%, which is probably a good thing. If you've been a central banker in Japan and you've witnessed deflation for so many years.
Well, if you're a central banker, you're getting what you finally wanted. If you're a consumer, you're getting screwed. The ironic thing about Japan is, if you look at Japan since the bubble peak in the late 80s, early 90s, up until a year ago, CPI averaged zero. True price stability. You have an aging population. The last thing you want to see is inflation, because it is destroying the standard of living of your citizens. So the fallacy of what the BOJ is wanting to do is they say, let's get higher inflation, and then wages will follow. But if inflation goes up 2 to 3 and wages go up 2 to 3, you're no better off.
If you're a retiree who doesn't work because you're retired.
Well, if you're a retiree, you're screwed because your cost of living is going up 3%. And your savings is getting your return of 0.1%. So you're in fixed income, you're getting screwed. If you're working in Japan, you're not seeing any progress in your quality of life because inflation is running, well, right now inflation's running faster than wages. Wage growth is picking up finally, but it's still lagging inflation. So I'm not a believer that higher inflation leads to faster economic growth. I think higher inflation actually leads to slower economic growth.
Slower real economic growth after adjusting for inflation.
Correct. Yeah. So I think the BOJ completely misdiagnosed their problem over the last couple of decades. They printed so much money and they killed the banking system in Japan and the savings hopes of its aging population, all to raise people's cost of living. To me, their low inflation was more of a symptom of slow growth rather than the disease.
Yes, but I think sometimes the argument can be the symptom causes the disease, which causes the symptom. That can be kind of a self-reinforcing cycle because, when there's deflation, there's an incentive to just hoard money and not spend anything.
Well, there's good deflation and there's bad deflation.
Yes, yes.
They had initially bad deflation in terms of these bubbles, this real estate and stock market bubble that collapsed, or I should say blew up. That was bad deflation. There's good deflation. Look at technology. Mm-hmm. The history of technology is deflation. That's good deflation. So I guess it also depends on how you define the deflation of some of it's bad, some of it's good. But when it comes to inflation, to me, higher prices are usually just a tax.
Peter, what would you say is your most controversial financial take right now, that your most contrarian opinion in the market, where you think the highest degree, highest percentage of market participants would disagree with you?
So I came into the year, and it's not working out so far, but not that bad, is that the Hang Seng was going to outperform the S&P 500 this year. and that the level of bearishness on Japan, I'm sorry, on China, had reached such an extreme. Now, of course, if China invades Taiwan, it's bad for them, but it's bad for all of us. The whole world, the economic world's going to be turned upside down if they do that and we start slapping sanctions. But what do you think is going to happen to the S&P 500 under that scenario? What do you think is going to happen to Apple stock under that scenario?
Or Nike or anything.
Yeah. So if that happens, we're all screwed. So I just thought that the bearishness was at such an extreme that the uninvestable Chinese stock market, let's bash China every single day, that it just had reached such an extreme that the Hang Seng, which there are companies on the Hang Seng that will benefit from growth in Asia, not just China, that index had bombed out and we're long parts of the market there. I mentioned Macau stocks. And I mentioned Trip.com, also long AIA Group, which is one of the largest life insurance companies in all of Asia that happens to trade on the Hang Seng. So I would say that is probably my more controversial idea.
Yeah, I mean, I happen to share your view, your bullish view of the Chinese stock market. It's been working out recently, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, the Hang Seng after a recent rally is up about 7.5-8%. It's beating the equal weight S&P, but it's certainly lagging the market cap weighted S&P.
What do you think of the Chinese economy right now, where some of the official data still looks good? I mean, if you just talk about real growth, you said the U.S. is going to do 1%, maybe 2% real growth. China's nominal growth is 5%, and they have deflation, not inflation. So their real growth is looking really good. But, you know, as you know, there's a significant property crisis, which might be not over.
So residential real estate, obviously under distress from the developer standpoint. Prices are falling, which then impacts sort of the wealth effect for the consumer, since a lot of consumer wealth is tied up in it. But on the other hand, with the consumer, there's a very high savings rate. Just as we did in the US, consumers have shifted their spending from goods to services. I'll mention Macau again. The visitor numbers in Macau are still very good. Domestic travel in China is above where it was pre-COVID. International travel is now growing, not only of Chinese traveling outside the country, but through a visa program, more people traveling to China. China spent $250 billion in 2019 in international travel. That consumer is now traveling again. If you look at manufacturing, China is still the manufacturing powerhouse of the world. And yes, they've experienced a recession in that area of the economy like everybody else. And they're probably going to do less business with the US and Europe because of all these tariffs. But China's trade with the emerging world is growing by leaps and bounds. Okay, US, you don't want my EVs? Okay, Europe, you don't want my EVs? I got the rest of the world to sell my low-cost, higher-quality EVs to.
Yeah, and they're producing a $15,000 electric vehicle with BYD.
Exactly, and there's a huge market for that in the emerging world. So now, I'm not a Xi fan. I understand the authoritarian nature. I am as libertarian capitalist as can be. So I have to sort of reconcile that when I look at China. But the amazing thing that I see about China is that there's still this incredible entrepreneurial culture and people that wake up and work hard every day. And it's a shame that they're suppressed by this government and what goes on there politically. But it's, like I said, it's not going to stop this middle class from expanding. It's not going to stop the rise in the middle class and the rise in per capita income. And you can play China's growth, not by owning a stock in China. Like I said, you can own a company in Japan that does business in China that will benefit from that, because don't count China out economically speaking. We'll have to see where the geopolitics go, but their geopolitical problems there, we're all screwed.
Yeah, and Peter, I can think of two threats to your bull thesis, which again, I happen to share, one of which is the property crisis causes a significant recession. In other words, it doesn't just affect the property market, it affects everything because people own property and it's gone down and the wealth, you have a wealth effect in reverse. So that's the first threat, property market. and the banking system. Second one is geopolitical. Which do you think is a bigger threat to your bull thesis, the property market or a geopolitical threat between the U.S. or the West?
Well, as long as Xi is in power, that geopolitical risk is with us every single day. As long as he is in interest of taking over Taiwan, we don't know how he'll do it kinetically or not, there is geopolitical risk. But he can drop dead tomorrow and China decides, you know what, we're going to go back to a more pacifist approach. We don't care to take over Taiwan. We want to embrace capitalism and the free market again, like what worked for them over the prior 30 years to Xi taking power. On the residential real estate side, we are multiple years into this distress. We have seen the biggest real estate developers in China go completely bust, with Evergrande being the perfect example, where the equity holders have been wiped out, bondholders have been wiped out. There has been an extraordinary amount of financial pain that has taken place in the Chinese residential real estate market. We're years into this process. Now, yes, it can continue to be painful from a wealth effect standpoint. No doubt about it, that could last a couple more years. I can't discount that. But from the residential developer standpoint, China has tried to rip the Band-Aid off. And it's extraordinarily painful, but they're well into this process. And the interesting thing is that the discounting that's going on in residential real estate is actually in tight. Existing home sales in China is actually doing okay. I specify existing because the Chinese home buyer or real estate buyer is still reluctant to buy that project that's only half built because they don't know if it's going to get finished. But 20% off in an already existing home, those sales are actually doing okay. So just as like the Indians like to buy gold, the Chinese still like owning real estate. And they're dealing with some pain right now, but there's still demand. There's still a massive amount of urbanization that still is going to take place. So I guess my point is that there are many years, a few years into this, that a lot of pain has already been experienced.
It's been experienced on the developer side, you know, and again, in the subprime bubble of in the US in 2008, a lot of the leverage was taken on by people who are buying the homes, and those loans were made by banks. This time, the leverage was taken on by the builders of the apartment buildings, Evergrande, Country Garden, and the like. Evergrande has gone bust, but the loans are still made by the banks. And so I haven't been paying that much attention to, you know, are the Chinese banks taking losses on these loans? Because presumably if you know, lend, I think Evergrande had what, hundreds of billions of dollars of debt, most of which, as you said, went bad. You know, it's collateralized by the building, but if the building went down in value, then, you know, you're not getting 100 cents on the dollar back. I mean, do you own any Chinese banks? Let me put it to you that way.
Yeah. So the Chinese banks, that's also another debate. The assets in the Chinese banking system is enormous. It is like 2x, 3x GDP compared to when the US at its peak, it was just this much smaller percentage. So yes, we have to focus on the exposure of these Chinese banks. But because they're state owned, you know, the state is going to back this. The problem with all these issues with the Chinese banks is going to be just more of access to credit is going to be tough. You know, we just saw Chinese loan data and it shows a continued slowdown in the pace of loan growth. M2 money supply grew 6.2% in June. I have data going back to the 90s, and it's never been this slow.
6.2%, that's growth, so it's not contraction, it's growth, but it's still way lower than...
It is the lowest in decades, and the lowest I've ever seen, going back the last, call it 30-plus years. So there is a credit crunch, and that also has to do with the distress in residential real estate and less demand for loans. There's a credit crunch going on in China. I don't want to discount the situation there. Banks are going to get hurt. There's going to be distress. But I guess my point is that we're already in the process. We're already trying to, when I say we, they're trying to get through this process. And, you know, it's going to be a drag for a while, but it's going to be a drag. There's no doubt. I don't want to cherry coat this.
Right. It's going to be a drag, but is it going to be such a drag that it justifies the market, the stock market trading at 12 times earnings or 10 times earnings? It's all about,
well, that's the thing, right? Is the stock market has already, to me, discounted a lot of this distress. I mean, well, the Shanghai Composite is still 50% below its 2007 high. The Hang Seng has just gotten destroyed. It was at its lows. It was trading at 8 times earnings with a 4.5-5% dividend yield. So I could argue that the markets have discounted a lot of this stress.
And what do you make of the market cap giants of China, your Tencents, your Alibabas, those types of names?
So they're dirt cheap as well. And the interesting thing about those names is their growth rates going forward are not in China. It's the rest of Asia. So it gets back to my growing Asia story. Again, half the world's population for Tencent and Alibaba and Pinduoduo and JD. I mean, there's an entire region of the world that are customers of theirs, potential customers of theirs. So I find those names also highly attractive.
Interesting. And then what do you think about a return of capital to shareholders, either through dividends or buybacks? If you have this cheap Chinese company and it makes a bunch of money and it trades at 10 times earnings, but if the money stays on the balance sheet and the rest of the investment world doesn't view that as money that can be contributed because the company's not doing dividends or buybacks and it's in China and there's a negative view of you know, Chinese governance, maybe the stock price doesn't go up. However, if it does buybacks, like I believe JD.com is doing, or I think Douyu, which, to be clear, I do not own. It's a very small cap name, but they did a special dividend to just distribute the profits. I'm starting to see a little bit more of return of capital shareholders.
So that is a very important point for two reasons. In order to buy back stock, in order to pay a dividend, you have to generate free cash flow, assuming the companies are not borrowing money to do that, which in today's capital markets in China, they're unlikely doing. They have to do that through cash flow. So we as well, if we're going to invest over there and take the risks, you have to invest in companies that are generating free cash flow that in the meantime are paying you back in some way. So that was a great point.
Thank you. Peter, earlier you said money growth, which really is bank deposit growth, I'm closely correlated to bank deposit growth or loan growth, is at 6.2%, lowest it is in China. Do you think that, you know, when people say the U.S. Fiscal situation is a bubble, there's a sovereign bubble in the U.S. because U.S. debt to GDP is so high, U.S. government debt to GDP is so high, I can understand that point. But then you look at, you know, China's situation, which, looking at the government's finances, it looks pristine because they have this huge surplus with the rest of the world. But their banking system is incredibly levered. I mean, which one's worse?
And their local governments are choking on debt. So the world is suffocating in debt. It's just a matter of what shell you sort of stick that debt under. So I agree. Now China is trying to address this debt. They've obviously tried to address it at the residential developer side, as we discussed. But they're also trying to address it at the local government side. And they're trying to be more transparent. They're telling these local governments, you got to bring all this debt on balance sheet. And if you do, you know, we'll help you out. We'll let you term out your debt like Greece did in 2011. Yeah, you got a lot of debt, but we're going to term it out for the next 50 years. So they're trying to deal with this. In the U.S. and Europe, have you seen any attempt at trying to deal with all this excessive spending and blowouts of debts and deficits? Absolutely not. Yes, we're all suffering from the same disease, but you know, the Chinese are trying to manage through this while the rest of us are not. And we're just still driving that truck at very high speeds down an icy road, wondering whether we're going to get into an accident. Eventually we will, but it hasn't happened yet.
Peter, now I've got a question for you, which, you know, it's a little controversial, and I rarely approach this area, but I feel like given the news that's happening, I have to. The presidential election, how are you kind of handicapping the odds of who's going to win between Trump and Biden? And how do you think the market would react to each potential scenario? And, you know, No political commentary other than that, but just those two questions.
I think if Biden or Harris is against Trump, Trump wins, hands down. If it's a Democrat other than Biden and Harris, it's going to be much closer and it's a coin toss. I think from an investor standpoint, there are only a couple of things that I'm focused on. Is we have a healthcare PM here. He needs to focus on, because Medicare and Medicaid dominate the healthcare industry, you know, he needs to focus on who's going to be the next president because of how policy will be affected. If Trump wins, I need to be focused on what kind of tariff battle are we going to have? What's that going to mean for inflation? What's that going to mean for manufacturing? Trump's tariffs sent U.S. manufacturing into recession in 2018. It killed off thousands of trucking businesses because there was less stuff moving around. But on the other hand, if Trump wins and he's able to extend the corporate tax cuts, and well, he's going to, because that's permanent. I mean, the income tax cuts, well, that'll be good, I believe, because who wants higher taxes? So now Biden didn't take off any tariffs. So that wasn't helpful either. So I think there are parts of the economy where they're going to directly impact, and most of the economy they're not going to impact. Spending wise, they're both be the same, because the entitlements, defense spending, and interest expense are only going to go up regardless of who wins. So the debate and the discussion of when does all these debts and deficits actually matter, that's not going to change that debate depending on who's going to win. Either president potentially is going to have to face that.
Got it. Final question for you, Peter. What do you make of the recent success and growth of not just private equity, but in particular private credit, private real estate, such as the Blackstone real estate investment vehicle, BREIT? You know, I think you're, as someone in the wealth management business, is it true that there's been a demand for illiquid private products where, you know, historically things that are liquid, things that are illiquid, you can't sell them. You have to sell them at a discount in a fire sale. Those would have an illiquidity discount. They'd be cheaper. But now it appears that illiquidity has been rebranded as a good thing because clients don't have to be worried looking at the stock market at 1 p.m. You know, they can relax. And maybe that is a good thing. But yeah, what do you make of this, you know, just this relentless rise of private credit assets, but also real estate and private equity?
Jack, we had dinner not too long ago with a group of people, and a similar question was raised to the table. And I raised my hand and I said, what's a potential canary in the coal mine here? And I said, Blackstone. And I said that because, number one, with higher interest rates relative to 15 years of zero, the economics of that business is much different. The returns on that investment in terms of what they made is much different. And the illiquidity issue, and we talk about BREIT, for example, of owning illiquid assets with your financing stream being able to take their money out with limits and gates whenever they want. And if we go into recession, which I think we will, now that private credit, private equity has become so reliant on the retail investor, that fickle retail investor, instead of long-term money, which was an endowment, an insurance company, a pension fund that can say to Blackstone, here's my money for 10 years, call me back in year 9, ahead of year 10. That retail investor is much more fickle. And I think that's where private equity, private credit made a mistake. They started to tap into fickle money for illiquid assets. And that imbalance, I think, is going to get exposed. It has started to with Starwood Property and the gates that they had to put up. We saw, obviously, with BREIT. But that is a major worry of mine, is all those wealth advisors start to get calls. Oh, I'm worried about that private credit investment. Yeah, I thought maybe I would hold it for 7 years. I know it's only 7 months later, but can I have my money back? To me, that is a huge, massive risk if rates, interest rates stay high for a while, and it eventually puts us into recession, which I think it will.
Wow. And just to explain that for the audience, so, you know, in 2008, obviously on the asset side, horrible quality loans that were made, but a real problem was they were funded with short-term money and, you know, in the wholesale money market, and banks could pull their money at any time. And that's what they did. An advantage of the private market space, you know, over the past 20 years, and it has been branded as such, is you don't have that. It's not being funded with, you know, money that could be pulled overnight. It's financed with long-term money. You're saying that now that's no longer the case, or it's less becoming the case, and it is being financed with money that can be pulled. But tell us about those gates, because on the Blackstone real estate product, BREIT, you know, clients are pulling the money, but it's being gated. There's a redemption limit. Wouldn't that save them? Because if Lehman Brothers had a redemption gate, they probably might still be here, right?
Yes, it saves them. It's smart for Blackstone to have that covenant, call it. It was 2% a month, maximum of 5% per quarter that you can redeem. But it doesn't stop the problem of constant redemptions. And if the economy rolls over and the real estate portfolio starts to generate less rental income, well, they're buying less properties. They're having to issue shares in lieu of actual preferred return dividends. Like, it becomes self-fulfilling in a way. And yes, Blackstone can control those redemptions via those gates, but it does alter the entire strategy. And you can imagine with the private credit side, I get probably 5 to 10 private credit emails every day.
From clients or from people, you know, private credit people wanting you to allocate money?
Deals. Yep. Oh, we'll get you equity-like returns.
For credit-like risk.
For credit-like risk, and you're senior in the capital structure, blah, 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 blah. And I think to myself, who is the entity on the other side of that 13% loan? GDP growth is 1.5%, I believe. And who's borrowing at 13%? I want to lend money to that person, that business. You can be senior secured, but if there's nothing below you, you're the entire capital structure and your recovery rate is not going to be much. So I'm just worried about the piles of money piling in, promising those returns, a slowing economy, and that money being fickle. Because again, a retail client has a much different time horizon, regardless of what they say, have a much thinner skin than that endowment, insurance company, and pension fund, which were the historical investors in private equity, because their time horizon matched up with the private equity firm.
You know, Peter, I was at a conference, and you know what I heard is people were saying a private credit ETF could be on the way.
That's not something that we would be looking to purchase.
Yeah, it really is funny. So you're not looking for those equity-like returns with credit-like risk?
No, I don't want to downplay this, because also part of the pitch is, well, the banks are retrenching, so we're going to fill that gap. Yeah. There is a funding gap that's needed. There's no doubt about it. There's a real estate landlord that needs a loan. There is a business that needs a loan. There is a need for private credit. All I'm saying is right now, with the flood of money coming in, with the economy looking very vulnerable, it's just now for me is not the time to own that. Maybe at some point there will be. Maybe coming out of a recession, private credit could be really attractive. But going into one, I'm less enthused.
And Peter, do you think that there will be much price discovery? Like, let's say a bank owned a loan to a speculatively, you know, non-investment grade company, and that there was a horrible recession. They might mark that loan down to 50 cents on the dollar, 40 cents on the dollar. Do you think a private credit thing, which emailing stuff to clients, which, you know, if you invested, you know, you'd be shown to you and your clients, what, you know, are they going to be marking it down with as much accuracy or mark to market prices? Maybe the fair value is higher, but if you had to sell it, you know, there's no market out there. Or do you think they could kind of just paper over the gap and say, well, actually, you know, it was 99 cents on the dollar, and now, you know, we've marked it down to $97.
Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of now there, we have direct lending where one entity will own the whole loan and whatever they mark it at, it's marked. But a lot of private credit, I think I read a stat that 85% of private credit is financing private equity deals.
Yes.
So, yes, you're going to have a situation where a lot of these private credit firms are not going to be all simpatico on where we should mark these loans. And then the private equity firm itself, you know, those equity, whoever owns those equity slices, we'll have to see where they mark it at. So there's going to be divergences on where these marks take place. But I also want, I want to emphasize again, about 85% of private credit is funding private equity deals. So private equity deals, the economics are less attractive because interest rates are higher. And now we're potentially going into an economic recession. I just think that anybody who's going to invest in this space needs to have eyes wide open. But your point, I've just recently read this week about those valuation marks being very different depending on where that loan lives.
Oh, yeah.
A BDC is going to market here. Some firm is going to market here. Another firm is going to market here. Who's right?
So I think I read it in an IMF report that actually a sponsor deals where you're lending private credit is lending to a private equity backed company, a sponsor backed company, they actually have a lower default rate because, you know, if you're lending to respected private equity company, they're not going to screw you because they know that's bad for your reputation, but that might not work in a recession. However, it is funny, like Peter, when you're making a loan to this company that's backed by the private equity company, oftentimes it's not going to the company, it's going to the private equity. So the private equity company can take money out and pay a dividend to its other investors.
Correct. Right? They have these NAV loans.
Yes.
As a perfect example. Luckily, there are some investors in private equity that says we will not invest in any private equity fund that has the potential for an NAV loan in the covenants. So yes, there private equity deal. Private equity at the end of the day is a levered long. Let's just be clear. For better or for worse, it's a levered long. They buy an asset, whether it's a public company they take private, or they buy a bunch of private companies, roll them up, or they buy an individual one, and they buy it with equity and they buy it with debt. It's a levered long. That's what it is, for better or for worse. So if you want to lend to that levered long, just make sure that what they do with that money and how much equity is in that deal. And make sure right now in today's environment, there's more equity than there was prior in case of an economic downturn. Make sure that the sponsor is not taking that loan and paying themselves a dividend, because then that company is even more levered.
How big of a threat do you think that is to the economy if this whole cycle turns the other way with private equity, private credit?
So I think in terms of the financial system, like 08, it's not like that. I just think that it's going to be a further, if this unwinds, you know, it's going to be a problem. It gets to my worries about, you know, a death by a thousand cuts type economy, as we continue to transition to this higher rate world. This transition is not over in 1 to 2 years. It's a multi-year process past that, because every year there's a lot of debt coming due that was priced pre-2022. And the regulators are finally like paying attention to this, you know, this shadow world, this non-banking world. But I don't think people appreciate the amount of money. And the non-banking exposure actually spills over into the banking exposure, because a lot of the big banks are providing financing to the non-banks.
Yes.
So this is all a world that we really need to pay attention to. If rates stay high, notwithstanding some rate cuts on the short end, and if the economy rolls over.
Yes. And there is some shadow leverage in the shadow banking system. I don't know exactly the details, but I mean, the IMF has noted it. So, you know, private credit, oftentimes those deals are levered. They're using borrowed money to then make loans. And I'd agree with you, the regulators are starting to pay attention, but they're in the they're in the stage, I would say, of writing very compelling and detailed and well-researched reports about them. They're not in actually regulating them.
I agree. They're going to be caught flat-footed, there's no doubt.
Yes. The Federal Reserve has a great report on private credit, which I can link. But Peter, we got to leave it there. It's Friday afternoon. We'll try and catch the end of Wimbledon. But Peter, you're a great man. Thanks for doing this. People can find you on Twitter at pbookvar. Where can people find out more about Bleakley Financial Group, as well as your publication, The Book Report?
They can check out Bleakley.com and learn more about our services. And The Book Report I have on Substack, so they can go there and check out my daily missives.
There you go. Thanks again, Peter, and thanks everyone for watching. Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vaneck.com/moatfg to learn more about the VanEck Morningstar Wide Moat ETF, ticker MOAT. Lastly, forward guidance is available not just on YouTube, but on all podcast apps, and a video version is available on Spotify and Twitter, where I post interviews regularly. Thanks again. Until next time.